WMDX Columbus, Madison's home for real news and great conversation. A Civic Media Station.
ABC News, I'm Wayne Cabot. Hurricane warnings now stretch as far north as the Bahamas from Hurricane Melissa. That monster storm now packing gusts of 200 miles an hour and blowing steady winds of 175. ABC News meteorologist Melissa Griffin worries about that wind and the storm surge and especially the rain.
We're looking at 20 to 30 inches for parts of Jamaica. This will bring life-threatening flash flooding, catastrophic mud and landslides across the region, especially in those higher elevations, which could reach up to 40 inches locally in those highest amounts. Even Cuba could see up to 20 inches of rain.
And Cuba is where the Guantanamo U.S. Naval Base is and where 1,000 non-essential personnel and their pets have been evacuated. House Speaker Mike Johnson says contingency funds are not legally available to continue the expiring SNAP food benefits. 42 million Americans will lose them Saturday. All this seems invisible to Wall Street, rallying on hope of a China deal. This is ABC News.
Madison, Wisconsin. Students, government, lakes, and 92.7 WMDX.
For 92.7 WMDX News, I'm Savannah Tome Olson. Authorities are now investigating after a social media post accused Madison school employees of assaulting a child. Madison police are on the case, and they say at least part of the story is inaccurate. It all started when a woman posted online accusing staff of Whitehorse Middle School of physically and sexually assaulting her 13-year-old son. In the video, she named those staff members, showed photos, and gave out what she said was their address, and even included a photo of the house at the address. The video has been seen tens of thousands of times, and some comments suggest violence against the staff members named. However, the State Journal talked to the homeowner at that address from her video, and he told the outlet that's his home and the employees have nothing to do with it or his family. Access Dane property records from the city assessor's office seem to confirm that. He says now people have been driving by or sitting outside his house. A spokesperson for the Madison Metropolitan School District says they pulled together a team to handle the situation according to district policies. And Madison police say they investigated through the weekend. A police spokesperson says they did initial interviews and reviewed security camera footage. They said, quote, details being widely shared on social media appear to be inaccurate and potentially harmful, end quote. Their statement says they, quote, ask the community to allow us to conduct a thorough and fair investigation, end quote. Of course, this comes after a violent attack in a West High School restroom that sent a student to the hospital a couple weeks ago. Video, later published by WISE, was incredibly difficult to watch. Two teens were arrested for that attack and another was ordered to court. The Madison Board of Education has a regularly scheduled meeting tonight, and they're likely to address one or both of these issues. We'll have more coverage for you in tomorrow's newscasts. I'm Savannah Tome Olson. You're listening to 92.7 WMDX News.
The Packers defeat the Steelers. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with Sports from Pittsburgh, where the Packers came back in the second half to win 35-25 over the Steelers. Wide receiver Christian Watson had four catches for 85 yards in his first game back after suffering a torn ACL in January. The defense sacked Steelers quarterback Aaron Rodgers three times. Micah Parsons.
Guys made plays when we had to make plays, which was huge, and we need that. We need that every week. It's great to have Christian back, honestly, and just everyone else just coming in. Like, I can't tell you how appreciative I am of the guys. Everyone who felt like they was having a bad game, like, we just rallied around each other.
NBA, the Bucks suffered their first loss of the season, 118-113 in Cleveland to the Cavaliers.
You know, it's so funny. We shoot the ball so well. I just thought we missed shots we made. And then the fouls, I thought, were the difference in the game.
That's Bucks head coach Doc Rivers. With Sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
92.7 WMDX, Madison's real news and great conversation, and home to the Todd Allball Show, Monday through Friday from 2 to 4.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Partly cloudy for tonight, a low around 40 to the low 40s. Looking mostly sunny for tomorrow, nice day with highs in the upper 50s. A few more clouds around tomorrow night, then back into sunshine on Wednesday. Highs into the mid-50s. It's 55 right now.
I'm Rick Smith, host of The Rick Smith Show. If you're looking for honest talk, real stories, and straight-up news that matters to you, tune in to The Rick Smith Show. We're digging into the issues that affect your job, your family, your future. Join me weeknights at 9 on the Civic Media Radio Network, because your voice deserves to be heard. That's The Rick Smith Show, heard weeknights at 9 right here on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
A very funny stand-up comic, Mr. Mike Toomey. The last time I saw a Goldie Hawn film in the theater, the male lead was giving her a foot massage, and it was the worst foot I've ever seen. I actually said out loud, I went, ew. And my aunt started cracking up.
Yeah, maybe they could have had a stand-in, like a stunt foot.
Please, something. Even if it's a guy's foot, I don't care.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. John Peterson and Gordy Young.
Tuesday morning, we'll check in with the Dane County Humane Society with Lisa Bernard.
And on Just Ask John, oven cleaners or self-cleaning ovens?
The John and Gordy Show, weekday mornings 6 till 8.
WMDX Madison, where biking in the snow is a personality trait.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
They wish to break the entire thing. That is the objective. It isn't about efficiency. It's about breaking it. And it's about breaking it for what end?
Now, the Maggie Dawn Show continues.
Gerrymandering is bad for everybody.
From Congress and courts to burgers and baseball.
I'm grossly discouraged, and I have given up on any justice in our system. It doesn't exist anymore.
Once again, here's lawyer and economist Maggie Dawn.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome back. If you're rejoining us, I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. My next guest, friend of the show, many of you will recognize his expertise as well as his voice. His name is Benga Ajilore. He is the chief economist for the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. He most recently served as a senior advisor in the Office of the Undersecretary for Rural Development at the USDA. You know, the USDA, that federal agency with multiple billions of dollars in contingency funds to fund, I don't know, programs like SNAP when there might be a government shutdown. Yeah, he used to help run that agency. So he's here to help us all be a bit smarter about what is going on related to both the shutdown, its immediate and longer term economic impacts, as well as what might be marinating over there in Asia with Donald Trump popping around Malaysia and Japan. Going to meet with President Xi of China in South Korea later this week. Big economic news there, as well as the fact that we've got a Fed interest rate announcement coming this week on Wednesday, just on the heels of the U.S. Department of Labor's announcement that we now have an inflation at 3%. We're going to get to all of that, but I am so privileged, happy, and humbled to welcome back to the Maggie Dawn Show economist Benga Ajilore. Benga, thanks so much for being here with us today.
Thanks for having me back. It's a pleasure to be here.
We got you for a whole hour because there's always so much to talk about in the economic news. And so let's start with what seems to be top of mind for everyone these days. For weeks, we have been focused on the Democrats' demand to refund the government, to agree to a continuing resolution to fund the government, that Republicans must agree to restore the funding for the ACA subsidies. Here in the state of Wisconsin, just today, the governor's office coming out with some of the estimates of the explosion in premiums that thousands of Wisconsinites are going to be seeing because Republicans, frankly, don't care if healthcare is affordable for people, apparently. But more recently, people have been focused on the fact that the U.S. government, the Trump administration, is basically saying that come November 1st, in a mere, 4 or 5 days, that people's supplemental nutritional assistance program benefits, their SNAP benefits, will not, those cards that people use to buy groceries to feed their kids, if they are elderly and need that support, if they've got disabled family members they're caretaking for, that those benefits aren't going to get loaded onto the card. Benga, in the immediate term, what's your reaction to this, especially having you worked at USDA? My understanding is they're sitting on billions of dollars that is literally a contingency fund designed for precisely this purpose. Why would the Trump administration allow people to go hungry?
That's a great question, and I don't have an answer because I don't understand what this administration is doing. But to your point, this is a fund specifically for this purpose. The government shuts down. They don't have the appropriations for the next year. They have about $5 billion to be able to put towards doing this until this tide over. And so there's literally no reason for them. And in fact, the purpose, the sole purpose of that fund is to be able to do that. And so there's no reason for them not to do that.
It's shocking to me. And there's so much, I think, misinformation that's out there about who receives SNAP benefits. For example, in the state of Wisconsin, 7 out of the 10 top counties that receive SNAP benefits are rural counties. Over a majority of folks that receive SNAP benefits here in the state of Wisconsin are white or self-report as white. We know that SNAP benefit usage is universal. It's a huge proportion of Americans. I guarantee anybody that's hearing my voice today, you know someone who is currently receiving SNAP benefits. For those that are of working age and able to work, meaning they are not in a full-time caregiver position, they do not have a permanent or semi-permanent disability, over half of those folks are working and still receiving SNAP benefits. So when you talk about working age people, these are people that are working, but simply working basically below a living wage at poverty levels. When you consider and include those folks, folks that are caretaking, folks that are themselves disabled, or folks that are raising small children, that's two-thirds plus of SNAP recipients fall into one of those categories. So I think a lot of the mythology or frankly, dog whistle, if I can call it that, about SNAP recipients is simply false. Other than trying to create leverage, I just don't understand why you wouldn't tap in to those contingency funds, especially when the president seemed perfectly willing to do that to ensure that members of our military continued to receive paychecks during this shutdown.
I don't know. And I think one of the things we have to think about is the broader context. We just had a couple months ago, the Republican Congress and the administration push a bill that cut $187 billion from SNAP. So this is kind of like a through line of just people who just don't care about people who need food assistance. And so at the same time, you have, you know, veterans who use this. And, you know, to your point, this is not people who aren't working. These are people who are working but don't get enough. And so this is a supplement to help people put food on the table so they can spend their money elsewhere. And, you know, one of the other things they want to spend their money on is health coverage, with, again, also being attacked during the shutdown, but also attacked part of the mega bill earlier this year.
Yeah, you call it the mega bill. I like to call it the big brutal bill because it is brutal for anybody that basically has a household income somewhere south of $250,000 a year or doesn't have, you know, like $40, $50, $60 million in the bank. If you're in one of those categories, probably a little bit of a boost for you, but the regular people here, it's incredibly damaging for. Here's one of the points I wanted to zoom out on. First of all, there is a through line between the attack on these programs that are designed to help working people and people who are unable to work due to their own disability or significant caretaking responsibilities for children or their elderly parents, or a disabled child, to help these people make sure, as well as the working poor, to make sure that they can have some baseline, not extraordinary, but baseline level of human dignity, get some health care. We know that when people get access to health care, that actually ends up keeping everybody's premiums down because folks seek preventative care. There's less care sought in emergency rooms. It's generally less expensive. You can just go look at Romney Care and what happened in Massachusetts. We know also when we look at emergency food assistance, that is a key element for folks that, again, are working poor in one of these other categories. We can look at the cuts that are proposed to take effect through Medicaid and Medicare, and on and on and on it went in the big brutal bill. What is this obsession, this, I think, factually dubious proposition that seems to have captured the entire Republican Party, that the only people that need help are people who don't deserve help? And yet at the same time, the people that apparently deserve help are billionaires and 100 millionaires and mega corporations. I don't understand how we can find money for tax cuts for the ultra, ultra wealthy folks with their names on buildings that are endowing museums and things like that. But we can't seem to find money to help people who are trying to help themselves. And there seems to be a factual rejection amongst Republicans that people that need these programs are working or are trying to help themselves. Where is the, you know, like, either Democrats are right and people are working and these are people who have earned these benefits and should be able to access them, or Republicans are right and this is all just one big scam. Like, both things can't be true at the same time. Everything that I've looked at from independent organizations, Benga, indicates that we're talking about people that are rightfully eligible for these benefits. Why is there this persistent lie that Republicans seem obsessed with for 40 years, that if people need help, it's because they're bad people and they don't deserve the help?
It's this narrative. And, you know, even though I'm going to be on for a while, you know, we can have, you know, a dissertation on this.
Yes.
This is, you know, even goes back before 40 years, where you just see this kind of push for lowering social spending and then using that, shift that to lower taxes. And this narrative around the deserving poor versus undeserving poor. And what happens is then that sticks. And so then to make the argument, to like, we need to cut, because this is not the first time SNAP and Medicaid have been cut. You know, there was a temporary assistance to needy families, which used to be aid to families with dependent children. And 96, you know, the Clinton don't end it, mend it, right? Like, that was part of that narrative. And we've just done it to the point where, like, TANF is basically a small program. And that's where we're headed with SNAP and Medicaid. And that was the argument that we heard all this year in anticipation of what you call the one brutal bill, is to be able to make that justification for to cut the spending. You have to talk about deserving versus undeserving poor. But we've been doing this for so long that argument is actually starting to fall on deaf ears, which is why we saw that rural health transformation fund, that $50 billion that basically doesn't do much, because they realize that they've gone too far. And so now we're seeing the same thing here. The reason why we're talking about the Affordable Care Act premium tax enhancements are, you know, going away, is that people understand their health coverage costs are going up and that this is not going to be good for them. Same thing with SNAP, so on and so forth.
Yeah, and we've seen, I think, experiments with this type of, I'm just going to call them, it's austerity economic policy. That's really what this is, except with it's austerity, except for we won't generate or continue to generate revenue at the levels that we have, because we'll give all of these tax breaks to folks that don't need them. And the tax breaks are largely a rounding error for these companies and folks that I'm describing. But we've seen, for example, when we look at Argentina, this sort of economic approach literally ended up tanking the Argentinian economy. It's why we're sending 20 or 40 billion to Argentina to prop up their peso with no guarantee repayment, except for perhaps the American taxpayer. We've seen Republicans as governors run experiments like this in states and collapse those economies. From an objective basis, Benga, are there indications that this works at all in an economy as diverse and as regionally diverse as we have here, that has been so reliant on a middle class with robust buying power since the post-World War II economy in the United States?
The only metric that we have to show that this works is the number of billionaires has increased like tenfold. But other than that, everything else has been hollowed out, especially a lot of the rural communities, a lot of the urban cores. And that's what's happened. We just basically hollowing out these communities that were strong and that were vibrant and were prosperous, all to, you know, for wealthy people.
Yeah, it's amazing. Over this period of time, I'm going to call it post-Nixon period of time, really, when Reaganomics has risen in preference amongst Republicans, and now this sort of offshoot of Trumpian economics, which we'll get into some of the tensions between what Reagan and even some neocons believed was good, robust economic policy. The one thing that has been true over that entire period of time is the explosion in income and wealth inequality in this country. They've got that in Argentina, too. Just saying, folks. Don't go anywhere. We're going to continue this discussion about what this economic moment means for Wisconsinites and working people everywhere in this country with the chief economist from the Center on budget and policy priorities. Benga Adjolari, friend of mine, now friend of yours. So don't go anywhere. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network.
Madison, Wisconsin. More lakes, more bikes, better radio. WMDX.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government buy-in for the people. The Trump Department of Justice announced October 24th it would deploy election monitors at five California counties on November 4th. DOJ says it is to ensure transparency and ballot security, but most of the counties are heavily Latino, competitive, or lean liberal, and the Proposition 50 redistricting question is on the ballot. In a statement, U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi said, "We will commit the resources necessary to ensure the American people get the fair, free, and transparent elections they deserve." Proposition 50 would suspend California's Independent Redistricting Commission until 2030, allowing the legislature to gerrymander more Democratic congressional seats, countering five Texas seats gerrymandered at President Trump's request. Kern, Riverside, Fresno, Orange, and Los Angeles counties were targeted, largely blue or toss-up counties. CalMatters reports that Fresno, Kern, and Riverside counties are majority Latino. A poll shows 54% of Latinos support Proposition 50. Governor Gavin Newsom had warned that the Trump administration might deploy ICE agents at the polls, a charge the administration denies. Quoted in CalMatters, Christian Arana of the Latino Community Foundation said, "These are citizens of this country, and if they are concerned about immigration or any type of federal presence at in-person voting sites, that is alarming." We have more at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
When it comes to vaping, the truth can get clouded. So let's make it clear. Vaping is not safe for youth.
Because vaping can put microscopic particles into your lungs.
And dangerous things like metals into your body.
And nicotine, which can harm a person's brain development through their mid-20s.
With appealing flavors, high nicotine levels, and lots of promotion on social media.
Many kids think vaping is harmless, but it's not.
So talk to your kids about the risks of vaping.
Because when you talk, they hear you.
Learn more at underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
Good news! You get an extra hour this weekend. Daylight saving time ends, so remember to turn your clocks back 1 hour before you go to bed Saturday night. Fall back, sleep in, and start your Sunday refreshed. A message from your local Civic Media radio station.
Local news, weather, and sports on air and streaming on the Civic Media app. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
Welcome back, everybody. Welcome if you're just joining us. My name is Maggie Dawn. I'm joined by the chief economist from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, Benga Adjolari. He's been here before. Love talking with him. We always have a good time trying to make what is going on in our economic news accessible. Benga, right before the break, I was talking about the fact, and then during the break a bit with you, about the fact that what we can see, I would say, over the last 50 plus years on a national economic performance level is repeatedly Republican presidents coming into office, putting in these austerity measures that ostensibly end up unquestionably hurting working folks and the middle class. You see bad economic results. And then you see Democratic presidents largely riding that economic dissatisfaction into office, then undoing some of the impacts of those policies, the economy picking back up again. And then you see this cycle repeat and repeat. What's interesting of note is that the state of Kansas back in May, I think this was 2010-12-ish, the 2010 aughts, I'll just say, Governor Brownback basically took the entire then dogma of what I'm going to call Republican austerity measures, put it into place everywhere in Kansas. There was no legislative pushback, and it ended up tanking Kansas's economy. Tell us a little bit about what people should know about what is now termed the Kansas experiment. I mean, he literally took Reaganomics lock, stock, and two smoking barrels and put that into Kansas's economy, and it failed miserably.
I think the way to think about this is that there's been this whole mantra on the conservative side, and to a certain extent on the Democratic side, where it's like you want to have small government, limited government, where, you know, get out of the way of the private market. And so you cut taxes, you cut spending, and then let the private market flourish. And what we see time and time again, it's not going to flourish. It flourishes for a very select few and everyone else on the backs of other people. And so this is what we always see, is that it's not just even austerity about cutting spending, but it's always paired with cutting taxes. You know, you go back to Clinton era, at the end, he had budget surpluses where, you know, we actually had more revenue than spending. And then the first thing Bush does is cut taxes in 2001, 2003, and then again, then the economy tanks in 2008. And then we start, you know, working back again. But then in 2010, you know, the House and Republican House engaged in austerity measures. And, you know, that's when we started seeing, you know, shutdown threats and things like that. So then the economy starts to build back up again. And then it's 2016. And then what do we see in 2017? A big tax cut. And then we had the COVID pandemic. And then there was a lot of money. And then, you know, we actually had a change with the Biden administration where we actually put a lot of money into the economy, a lot of money to, you know, lower and medium income families. And then now what we see this year, same thing, tax cut, spending cuts.
And a lot of this, I mean, if we read beyond just what the headlines are, and you know, at the beginning of this second hour of my show, we play a bit of sound where I talk about the point is to break the thing. This isn't about reform. This isn't about increased efficiency. The true point, if you read Project 2025, which is we're simply checking off the list in Project 2025 in Donald Trump's second administration. It is very clear to anyone who has worked in government for more than 5 minutes that the objective is not better delivery of core services. It is stopping core services from being delivered by the federal government, that it is about basically breaking the Affordable Care Act so that it collapses, right? So that the risk pools, so that health insurers do not want to participate and will not provide insurance through the ACA. It is to break programs like Medicaid and Medicare and SNAP. It is not to make those better. And when you look at the Kansas experiment, I mean, that was the Koch brothers, that was Alec, right? That was the bastardization of what Arthur Laffer, you know, supply side economics, which wasn't really what Arthur Laffer ever stood for. It's just a sort of a confused idea of that. This has been scripted. It has been in the Republican playbook, but it is just turbocharged with this added use of tariffs, which is the newfangled tactic from Donald Trump. And this has not worked. It literally plunged Kansas's economy into a recession. Many could call it a depression. The legislature in Kansas tried to undo all of this austerity and tax cut slashing. The governor vetoed it. They had to come back and override his veto to try to save their economy. When we look at this kind of, I think, head in the sand, an objectively unreasonable approach to economics that does not work, and you then take it with this Trumpian chaos tariff policy, which I can't even use the word policy. It changes every day. This is not going to be good for the middle class. And it's really a question of when, not if, right? We see that we haven't really felt the full impact of the tariffs as much as we thought, as fast as we thought, but it is coming. Is it not, Benga?
It is coming, but for some people, it's already here. Just look at what's happening with the farmers. Yes. And, you know, they have the tariffs on their inputs. So you're looking at fertilizer, steel, aluminum. They're already getting harmed by that. You see what happened with soybean farmers, with China stopping purchase. So for, you know, a lot of people, it hasn't come, but for a lot of people, it's already here and they're already feeling the pain.
We're going to come back with Benga Adjelori, chief economist with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. On the other side, we're going to dig in to Donald Trump's taco tariff terror. What does that mean for consumers? Maybe the holiday season? What does this maybe framework to get off of the ledge with China mean? All of that, so much more coming up. Don't go anywhere. I'm Maggie Dawn, and you are listening to the Civic Media Radio Network.
WMDX in the Mad City, Four Lakes, State Street, and 9,000 hemp shops.
92.7 WMDX, Madison's real news and great conversation, and home to the Todd Allball Show, Monday through Friday from 2 to 4.
For 92.7 WMDX News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. Governor Tony Evers is pushing to get FEMA disaster funding after the Trump administration said no. Evers says the Trump administration denied Wisconsin's application for public assistance for Door, Grant, Milwaukee, Ozaukee, Washington, and Waukesha counties after those severe storms and flooding in August. In response, the governor announced he'll file an appeal to ensure those six counties get the support they need to rebuild, recover, and address more than $26.5 million in disaster costs. In a letter sent to the governor, FEMA said that while the impact to individuals and households was significant, based on the preliminary damage assessments, quote, it has been determined that the public assistance program is not warranted, end quote. Those preliminary damage assessments last month included people from FEMA, emergency management, and local officials. They all validated that more than $26 million in damage. Now, the governor is directing Wisconsin Emergency Management to gather more information on all that damage to the public sector and certain nonprofits for the future appeal. And a reminder, part of John Nolan Drive will close overnight this week starting tonight. The northbound lanes of John Nolan will close at 7 o'clock, and it'll open back up in time for the morning rush at 6 o'clock in the morning. Crews will be installing storm sewers as part of the years-long reconstruction project. It'll continue to close every night this week through Thursday. And another road closure started this morning. Packers Avenue is closed at the railroad tracks. The railroad company is replacing the crossing. There's a detour using North Sherman and Aberg Avenues. That project on Packers Avenue is expected to also take just 4 days. City staff say it should be open again Thursday by 5 p.m. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson, 92.7 WMDX News.
On your entertainment beat, I'm Pete Schwabba. Some of you might remember Jeremy Renner from the less popular Bourne movie. It was pretty subpar, although not entirely his fault. In 2023, on New Year's Day, the mayor of Kingstown actor was seriously injured after saving his nephew from being crushed by a 14,000-pound snowplow. The Hurt Locker star had 30 broken bones, including 14 broken ribs, a spinal fracture, a broken tibia, a punctured lung, a sliced liver, a broken and dislocated collarbone, and a major head laceration. Season 4 of yet another Taylor Sheridan show, The Mayor of Kingstown, drops October 26th on Paramount. This is the age of the re-release, and you can add Wedding Crashers to the list of films that you can see soon on the big screen. The Owen Wilson Vince Vaughn comedy celebrates its 20th anniversary by heading back to theaters. Warner Brothers says the film will hit theaters again December 4th and 11th. For more showbiz fun, tune in to Nightlight with me, Pete Schwabba, weeknights from 6 to 8 p.m. on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Mad City. Biking through blizzards since forever. 92.7 WMDX.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Partly cloudy for tonight, a low around 40 to the low 40s. Looking mostly sunny for tomorrow, nice day with highs in the upper 50s. A few more clouds around tomorrow night, then back into sunshine on Wednesday. Highs into the mid 50s. It's 55 right now.
Hey there, Wisconsin. Tom Hartman here. Democracy is not a spectator sport, so join me each and every weekday right here on Civic Media for the Tom Hartman program from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Covering the news of the day and sharing ways for you to get off the sidelines and get active in your community, because change starts with you. Get involved and tune in to the Tom Hartman program Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. right here on your local Civic Media radio station.
Drivers, Austin Cindric here. As a NASCAR Cup Series driver of the number 2 Discount Tire Ford Mustang, there's a few rules of the road I like to tell my family and friends. Tire pressure is critical to safety because underinflated tires are more likely to fail. Plus, properly inflated tires will give you better gas mileage. Make sure to check your tire pressure at least once a month or stop by a local tire retailer for an air check.
A message from the U.S. Tire Manufacturers Association.
Pete Schwabach.
On the next Nightlight, I welcome Dustin Mack from Appleton's History Museum at the Castle. We talk Wisconsin Dells ghost boat tours, and musician Strategic joins me in studio. Let's light it up.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabach. Weeknights from 6 till 8.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. You are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. I've got the chief economist for the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, Benga Adjelore, with me this afternoon. We've spent really the first half hour, Benga, talking about, you know, these two things that are happening right now related to the shutdown, which is the Trump administration's failure, of course, to use the contingency fund, billions of dollars worth, that exists in USDA exactly for the express purpose of funding SNAP benefits or other benefits that might be cut off during a shutdown. They're refusing to do so because apparently they don't care about people going hungry. We've been talking about the Democratic demand to restore the ACA subsidies that, while our healthcare system is so far from perfect, and while it remains anathema to me that healthcare is something that we permit to be provided on a for-profit basis in this country, that is at least helping millions still access affordable healthcare. They don't care about that. And we've talked about how, on a much higher level, we've seen cycles of Republican presidents putting in place, as much as they have been able to, these austerity measures to cut the programs that help working people, people with disabilities, people that are in caretaking situations, maintain the lowest level of human dignity. But it's not true austerity because they're not trying to raise revenues. In fact, the same time they cut those programs, they're basically giving welfare to mega corporations and billionaires who don't need it, and it's a rounding error for them. And we've seen that those cyclical federal levels of policy are often then balanced by Democratic presidents coming in and trying to undo some of those policies, leading to economic growth, speeding up, betterment of the middle classes, and then reverts back to a Republican. What we have now, and we teased this a little bit before the break, is Donald Trump effectively taking that failed Reaganomics model. And again, folks, you can look at various South American countries, most recently Argentina, who applied that and has tanked its economy. The Kansas experiment back from the Tea Party time in the mid-2010s, as another example of how those policies fail. But what we have now is that plus, quote unquote, I don't even want to call tariffs protectionist. Tariffs used at this level are not protectionist. They are the explicit pickers of winners and losers in the economy by a president who's being guided by nothing more than his lust for power and control over various industries. We've seen Donald Trump trying to have the government own portions of NVIDIA. I mean, there's so much weirdness going on that former Republican free traders or free market capitalists would be appalled by. What is this doing, the combination of these things? What is this doing for the middle class? Why haven't we seen as much inflationary pressure as many economists expected from the tariffs? Is it still coming? What should people be concerned about as we move into the holiday season and into 2026?
So you bring up a good point that, you know, with Trump and his lust for tariffs that's been ongoing for like 40 years, and now even in his first term, he wanted to use tariffs like this, but he had a lot of people in his administration who curbed his ambition. And now you don't have those people. And so that's why you have tariff by tweet policies where you have, you know, he watches a TV commercial and then says, I'm going to put 10%, gets upset, gets offended, and adds another 10% to tariffs to Canada, where you just have this kind of wild, you know, chaotic, haphazard tariff policy. And the reason why we haven't seen it translate totally, it is in some of the prices of certain goods, but we haven't seen it abroad because businesses have been able to anticipate this. So you saw it a lot in the first quarter of this year, a lot of inventory buildup, a lot of stuff, so that when the tariffs did hit, everyone was worried about April 2nd, that Liberation Day, they would say, okay, well, we may have to pay more in terms of inputs and things like that, but we could eat those costs and we eat this cost and then we'll be able to ride through this. now all those inventories are gone, and now, you know, they're just going to have to bear it. And so come this season, the holiday season, and we're already starting to see it with certain prices, there's, you know, people look at Halloween candy going up. Yep. In fact, one of the issues with Halloween candy is that chocolate's become more expensive. So if you go to the grocery store, you might see a lot of different candy and not chocolate type candies. It's going to be really interesting to see, but we're going to start seeing it, and we're seeing it in different ways. It's not just the price going up, but, you know, maybe smaller portions, different kind of candy, things like that. But at some point, it's going to hit with prices.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. You can look at companies trying to build up inventory. So companies that are able to afford to amass inventory to do that, especially companies that have bargaining power. So when I say that, I mean large companies that have big balance sheets, that have cash on hand, they can amass inventory. They have bargaining power to try to keep their suppliers at lower level of input prices. They're able to adjust inventory mix. If you are larger retailers or you sell a mix of different products, you can adjust those. Again, using leverage for our largest businesses to maintain some pricing advantage. This is the Main Street versus Wall Street, the Walmarts versus your locally owned Ace Hardware or other hardware store, for example. I think there's also, and you tell me what your view on this, I think that there was a very clear incentive structure in place with this Oval Office for companies to try to minimize the impact of those tariffs. I think you've seen an earnings call. You and I discussed the Walmart earnings call last time at length. Companies that have tried, I think, with a lot of knowledge that, especially if they are market makers or industry indicator, big companies, that they don't want to draw the president's attention, negative attention, if they came out and said, yeah, these Trump tariffs, boy, those prices that consumers are paying, they're going right up. Nobody wants to come out and say that, because Donald Trump absolutely will engage in company-specific retaliation. He did it, I think, to less effect in Trump 1.0, but to great effect in Trump 2.0, both the carrot and the stick of it all specifically directed at various companies. Is that part of the incentive mix here for companies as well, companies that are able to eat those costs because they are mega corporations or very, very large?
We actually saw this with Amazon in April. Amazon, they had shown some prices, and there was actually like a line item that said something about tariffs. And then Trump got really upset. And then Jeff Bezos, or who was leading Amazon, they were like, oh, no, that's not it. And he took it off and they make sure. And so we've seen that actually happen. And the other thing to that point is that it's not about, you know, some of them are able to eat their costs, but some of them, because they have a, you know, open door at the White House, are able to get exemptions from it. We saw this with Apple. There was the tariffs going to be put on computer and computer products, and Apple was able to, you know, get an exemption on that, so they wouldn't be hit. And so that's the thing about being a big, large corporation. It's not just that you have the ability to, you know, tie yourself over with the tariffs, but you also have the ability to lobby this administration to be able to be not subject to it, that small mom and pop businesses don't have access to.
And again, so we see, you see it on the individual level, this austerity, but not for rich people and mega corporations. You see that same, I'm going to call it different rules applying for small businesses. They're going to be unquestionably hurt and have been hurt by the tariff terror, even just adjusting their systems for tariff rates that are changing almost on the daily from the Trump administration. Much harder for smaller businesses. But on the aggregate, smaller businesses don't have the margins. They don't have the bargaining power. They don't have the cash flows to maintain inventory levels or to curry favor and cut big checks for the vanity ballroom or whatever it may be. For this presidency, it's even on the corporate level, the president's economic policies are not designed to help the little guy. They're designed to help the donor class, whether that's at a corporate or individual level. That's who this economy is working well for. That brings me, Benga, to what is going on with China. When I think of a country whose interests may be at least different from the United States, at the most threatening perhaps an actual foreign adversary on both a foreign policy and economic power on both of those axes to the United States, but also a country who can have enormous impacts on the middle class, so much of what we consume as a consumer-driven middle class. A lot of that stuff is coming from China, whether we're looking at our trading partners for farmers and the soybean industry here in the United States. China is an essential trading partner, and it is probably the single country in the world now that has as much, perhaps more, economic power than the United States. So Donald Trump is in Asia this week. He was in Malaysia. He's in Japan today. He's going to be going to South Korea and will be meeting with President Xi of China. Scott Bessent this weekend announcing that there is a, quote, framework to move China and the United States off of this full-on trade war cliff that we seem to be nosing over. How important is this moment, and how prepared is Donald Trump to understand the potential ramifications of the different levers that may be on the table to try to reach a trade detente or even a minimum de-escalation between the U.S. and China?
I don't have a lot of faith in this administration, because we are now entering month 10 of the administration, and they've been dealing with China with tariffs since February. And, you know, even with other countries, they say, oh, we have a framework or we have a deal. And then 3 days later, someone from that other country saying, that's not what we agreed to. And so yeah. We actually don't see the documents. And the other thing about trade deals is that that's not something you could do in a couple of days. This is months, years worth of work, documented work that starts from the staff, career staff, and some of the political appointees at, you know, Department of Commerce and things like that who do it. This is, can't be just some administration doing a tweet saying I made a deal. And so I just don't have a lot of faith that they're going to be able to reach a deal, because we haven't seen anything since.
When I wonder, like, what, when we look at the leverage points that China has over the United States, rare earth minerals, right? Huge. They are a major importer to the United States of consumer goods that many middle-class households rely upon, electronics, etc. And we look at China as an importing of major agricultural products. Where is our leverage coming from? I know China wants access to our markets and our consumers, but given that it is a state-controlled economy, President Xi seems to be able to exert a lot more control over that economy, and they have things that we need in the immediate term, read rare earth minerals and those consumer goods. Where is our leverage going to come from?
We don't have much leverage, and the Chinese know that they could kind of wait us out, that they could wait this administration out. There's even talk about, like, the TikTok deal was kind of like just something to give us to tie us over. And so we don't have the leverage. And that's what's scary about what's happening and what will happen in the coming months.
I'm hearing reporting earlier today that there are many in the depleted but still existent U.S. Department of State that are deeply worried that Donald Trump might have some announcement about the U.S. going hands off in Taiwan and the global catastrophe that could portend. Watch this space. When we come back, we're going to talk about where interest rates stand right now, what the Fed's interest rate announcement this week could mean, and how all of that relates to the consumer price index and what we are seeing writ large for inflation. So stay tuned. It matters to your pocketbook and mine. We got Benga Adjelori, chief economist at the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, with me, Maggie Dawn, right here on the Maggie.
Connecting audiences, powering brands. This is Civic Media. Learn more at civicmedia.us/advertise.
At Allure Intimate Apparel, fit is everything. Not just how something feels, but how it makes you feel. Bras, sleepwear, swim, and intimates, Allure has it all. Their industry professionals and trained fit specialists deliver a discreet, graceful experience that honors every figure. It's style without compromise, elegance without effort. Allure is thoughtfully expanding. Come visit their brand new Hilldale Shopping Center location, where women will discover how fit and confidence go hand in hand. Visit AllureFits.com.
Herbal Aspect has landed. That's right, Madison's go-to cannabis destination now has a brand new location in Sun Prairie.
Wait, four locations? That's a high level of convenience.
With three Madison locations and now Sun Prairie, a great cannabis experience is always close by. Our expert staff is here to help, whether you walk in, call, or order online. Mention Radio 420 and get a special discount. So stop by Herbal Aspect in Sun Prairie, because great cannabis isn't just a pipe dream.
Nice. I'm rolling over now.
Herbal Aspect.
The leaves are still fairly green, but don't get comfortable. Madison fall arrives like a badger blitz. One day you're at the terrace in shorts, the next you're hunting for flannel. 92.7 WMDX is here through every season change and wardrobe crisis. Real news and great conversation. WMDX. Weathering Madison's beautiful unpredictability.
This is Chad Spade. Sometimes I'm overwhelmed by the hatred and misinformation that consumes our world, but I also know that we cannot build a house of justice and inclusion on a foundation of hatred and lies. We have to practice what we preach. At Chad's Design Build, we confront injustice the same way we confront a poorly built home, with love, compassion, intelligence, and persistence. We engage our community the way we engage our clients, with honesty and humility and the dogged determination that we can do better. Chad's Design Build, remodeling done well with love.
You can support animals in need in our community when you shop at Dane County Humane Society's thrift stores. Thrift Store West on Watts Road and Thrift Store East on High Crossing Boulevard. Shop gently used and new clothing and accessories, home goods, toys, furniture, and a whole lot more. All proceeds from the Dane County Humane Society's thrift stores support the comfort and care of animals in need across the county. Visit giveshelter.org/thrift for more information.
My name's John Driscoll, proud member of the Patriotic Millionaires. When I was CEO at CareCentrics, I doubled entry-level wages. The impact? Productivity went up, turnover went down, and the company was successful. When employees are off the clock, they're real consumers, the consumers that drive the economy with their spending. By paying employees a fair wage, we're actually helping out all of us in giving our economy the best chance to succeed. I'm John Driscoll. I'm a Patriotic Millionaire, and I approve this message.
As Wisconsin is saying the word bag instead of bag. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
Welcome back, everybody. Welcome if you're just joining us. My name's Maggie Dawn, and this is the Civic Media Radio Network. We're in the last segment of the day, and I've asked my good friend, Chief Economist for the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, Banca Aggelori, to stick around with me. We've been talking about the current state of play here in the United States when it comes to economics and some of the recent goings on. We have covered the disconnect, the fact that Republican policies just don't work well for the middle class or working poor folks. It doesn't work well for small businesses. And there is 50 years of objective economic data to support that. We've talked about the fact that even when you turn to the traditional Republican policies, what we've got with Donald Trump is sort of turbocharged to hurt regular Americans and benefit the ultra, ultra wealthy, the donor class, and the mega corporations with Donald Trump's taco tariff terror that seems to flippity floppity every other day and seems to have no through line other than what's going to work for Donald Trump and his billionaire donors. That's a departure from traditional Republican economic orthodoxy, this broad use of tariffs. And late last week, Donald Trump seemed to be surprised to find out that the man most revered by most Republicans, Ronald Reagan, was quite anti-tariff. One of the provinces in Canada put out an advertisement on social media in opposition to Donald Trump's strong-armed tariff tactics vis-a-vis Canada, and quoted from a speech that Ronald Reagan gave about tariffs back in the 80s that basically said, these don't work. These drive up consumer prices and hurt businesses in the United States. It was basically the nutshell. And Donald Trump is now threatening to shut down all trade negotiations, or did that, and maybe higher tariffs on Canada. We are already seeing them on steel, timber, and aluminum, which is hurting housing starts and all kinds of businesses that rely on those inputs here in the United States. But, Benga, were you a little surprised? Maybe not surprised is the wrong word. Riley amused by the fact that Donald Trump seemed utterly shocked, I say, or completely unaware of the fact that traditional Republican orthodoxy is very anti-tariff, that Ronald Reagan was very anti-tariff. He seemed to not know that little tidbit.
He did seem pretty surprised by that, which is not shocking because he doesn't really know much outside of what he believes and just assumes everyone goes along with him. And so what is actually really funny about that ad was that it was actually played also during the World Series between Toronto and L.A., and so a lot of, you have millions of people are watching it who see that ad and hear Ronald Reagan's words being anti-tariff. And so he probably felt there was somewhat needling him.
I think they were. I mean, that's the Canada's been pretty good at Trump trolling, I would have to say. A national hobby, if you will. Of course, we got game three of the series this evening. Personally, I'm going to be rooting for the Blue Jays because who wants the team with the biggest payroll in baseball to win? That's just nonsense. But he claimed that it was AI generated. I went and looked up the speech, the clips that were used in the advertisement. To the best of my ability to research and decipher this, and what I saw verified in other news reports, is that they were clipped. And maybe not in the order that Reagan said them, but he said those things and they didn't alter. There was no AI generated Reagan voice. Like, I wonder, Benga, is anyone there in the Oval Office saying, no, Mr. President, don't say that. Reagan did say those things. Are you curious to know why Ronald Reagan was so anti-tech? Like, there's no one there telling the man the truth about anything, which just seems to be so shocking. Why do you think, just this is wild speculation, but I'm fascinated by it, Benga, why do you think a guy like Scott Bessent, who clearly knows better, I don't know about Lutnick the Nudnick, but Scott Bessent knows better, why is he not saying any of this to the president?
I think what we have is that when you look at people who are in the White House, people who are working for the White House, they have a specific point of view. And it's a point of view that aligns with what the President Trump wants. And unlike the first term where you had people with different views and debates and be able to push them certain ways, if you believe that tariffs don't work, you're not working at this White House. So anyone who works at the White House who saw that ad would then say, oh, just say it's AI generated and keep doing what you're doing. And so anyone who's choosing to work with this administration is aligned with everything that this president wants.
Yeah, or they've been kicked out, quote, early retirement, and those other ideological purges that have happened. Briefly, we saw the Department of Labor last week, despite the fact that data collection is basically shut down during the shutdown. Looks like the CPI is now at about 3%, which is up a bit, but not quite yet at the inflation alarm level. We've got the Fed that's going to make an interest rate announcement on Wednesday. Most expect the Fed to reduce interest rates. What's going on there with this interrelationship between increasing inflation, but it's not skyrocketing, and the Fed and the interest rates? What are they trying to accomplish right now?
So they're trying to balance that trade-off between making sure that unemployment doesn't go up and that the labor market stays strong and that prices don't go up. And so while they understand that prices are going up because of tariffs, what they're saying is that the tariffs are only going to have a temporary impact and that the labor market is actually weaker. And so they're making the decision and they're probably going to do another quarter percentage point cut to make sure that the labor market stays strong and not be as worried as with inflation as much.
Fascinating, given the Trump flip-flopping. If it really was such a golden panacea, why would he be negotiating such lower trading tariff rates? Nobody knows, because he just makes it up. But my guest doesn't make it up. Big thanks to Benga Agilore from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. It's a pleasure to be with you, as always, Benga. He'll be back soon to give us more economic updates. That's going to do it for me, folks. Remember, I'll stand up for you. I hope you stand up for me. But it's always better when we stand together for the middle class.
This is 92.7 WMDX Columbus, Madison's home for real news and great conversation. A civic media station.
ABC News, I'm Wayne Cabot. What's it like to be on an island expecting their biggest storm on record to hit overnight? To Kingston, Jamaica, and ABC's Ike Ejachi waiting on Category 5 Melissa, with winds of 175 miles an hour gusting to 200.
What we're seeing right now is massive amounts of rain starting to come onto the island in intermittent bands, along with those strong winds. Now, we went out around the island just in the past hour or so, and we started to see those effects essentially batter the coast. Those strong winds, that storm surge, is essentially going to engulf Kingston and affect the rest of the island.
It could wash away homes with an inundation of 13 feet. The U.S. has evacuated 1,000 non-essential personnel and their pets from the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base in Cuba, which is on Melissa's current track. The Bahamas, now under hurricane warnings. Military members are due to miss their first paychecks this week. Air traffic controllers, too. Food assistance for 42 million Americans runs out Saturday. This is ABC News. Cigarette.